you may proceed.
May it please the court. This court must reverse the district court's summary judgment and render judgment for InterQuest for two independent reasons. First, multiple contract provisions exclude from the obligation to share the very interest that InterQuest acquired from PKE Dyersdale and Patty DeBose. That is, interest that those two parties to the development agreement owned prior to the effective date. The district court erred in failing to give effect to those provisions and, in effect, rendering them meaningless. Second, the area of mutual interest violates the Texas statute of fraud because there is no description in either the development agreement or in any writing referred to in the development agreement that identifies the property subject to that AMI with reasonable certainty. The district court erred in considering extrinsic evidence, that is, shaping files or mapping data that is not referred to in the agreement. It is not referred to on the map attached to the agreement, and that is error under Texas law. And I would like to address the second issue first under the statute of frauds. This is not a case where there's a disagreement over the law. The law is well settled. Long Trust versus Griffin, which this court cited extensively in the Coe versus Chesapeake opinion. A contract for the sale of real estate under Texas law to satisfy the statute of fraud must, within the contract itself or within a writing identified in the contract, provide the means of identifying the property with certainty. The law is that extrinsic evidence, when it's proper at all, can only be used to clarify or explain the description. It cannot be used to provide the location. And that's exactly what happened in this case. And as they say, a picture's worth a thousand words, and we put the map side by side in our reply brief at page 11 and 12. And on page 11, we show the maps that were the maps at issue in the Coe versus Chesapeake case. We compare the map that was attached to the agreement to the map that the trial court admitted. And as this court noted in its opinion, they are identical maps except in size. And you can see that on page 11. They're the same map. Contrast that to the map that was attached to the Sitel agreement with the map that Appley's expert created. You see the map attached to the Sitel agreement. I'm not sure what I would call that shape, but it doesn't even have a complete inclusion. The map in our brief, I believe, is oriented where the east is on the top. We don't have an eastern boundary. We don't have a southern boundary. There's no way of knowing what the area is. Compare that to the map that Appley's expert created from this data that was not referred to. There, it's a very nice oval with a complete enclosure. This is the exact thing that the law says you can't do. You cannot use extrinsic data to provide the location of the property, and that's what happened. They can say that the seismic shape files are referred to on the map, but they're not. We can look at it, they're not referred to. There is a reference to the Texas State Plane Coordination System. That's something different. That does not link to shape files on the map itself. As their expert testified, she had to call up Appley's counsel and say, hey, can you go get me the mapping data from this non-party to the agreement? And then I can use this mapping data to draw a new map. That's exactly what happened. That does not satisfy the statute of frauds. Now, they do make a second argument that the exception for partial performance saves it from the statute of frauds. Having made that argument, they had the burden to prove that exception applies. Again, there's no question about what the law is on that. If one party acting in reliance has suffered a substantial detriment for which it has no adequate remedy, and the other party is permitted to plead the statute, would reap an unearned benefit, and it's tantamount to a virtual fraud. What the cases tell us that virtual fraud requires is it has to be partial performance that is unequivocally referable to the agreement, and it the performance must be such as could have been done with no other design than to fulfill the particular agreement sought to be enforced. That's what they had the burden to prove. Only one of the appellees submitted any evidence to try to meet that standard, and it fails. There's a declaration of Fred Yates that says, I got this email from InterQuest president, says if we acquire these interests, we'll be offering them. That was a mistaken email. We admit that. He quickly corrected it. And Yates said, well, when I got that, I'd had an engineer looking at this property for the last year. Now, they hadn't made an offer on it for the last year, but they had an engineer looking at it for the past year. And when I got InterQuest email, I told him, stand down, and we'll wait and see what InterQuest does, and then we'll wait and decide whether we want to take our pro rata share. That's not performance. Yates is saying they hadn't even decided if they wanted to perform. That's inaction. And that none of the other appellees have even that much evidence. We've found no authority, and appellees have cited no authority, where a failure to act can constitute partial performance sufficient to take a contract out of the statute of frauds. The cases, the typical cases, and we cite an example of one in the brief, maybe more than one, is on an oral contract for real estate. There's an oral contract. The purchaser pays money, moves on the property, does improvements. That's the sort of partial performance under the law that can get you out of the statute. That we have none of that here as a matter of law. So we believe that the agreement violated statute of fraud, and considering these extrinsic shape files to draw a new map is precisely what the statute of frauds says you cannot do, and the partial performance exception was not proven as a matter of law. Alternatively, at the very least, it would have been a fact issue had they been able to generate one. We don't think they created a genuine issue of material fact. But even if they did, the district court erred in resolving that fact issue on partial performance as a matter of law at the summary judgment stage. Let me turn now to the contract argument.
Before you do, the statute of frauds argument, if you prevail on it, I assume it's more dramatic in its consequence than...
Excuse me, Judge.
Basically, I'm curious which theory you prefer to win on if you're going to win, given that the consequences are very different. The statute of frauds, I think, obliterates the whole contract, whereas your contract interpretation agreement argument would be narrower. Are you ambivalent as to these two theories?
Well, we are asserting alternative theories. We obviously don't believe that even if the contract is valid, that it applies to these interests, which is the second argument. Statute of frauds is a transaction-by-transaction analysis, as is partial performance. So if the court finds that there's a statute of frauds problem, I believe the parties, if they want to still have an agreement, could probably go cure it. But I guess we're seeking relief on both grounds.
You're ambivalent as to the two theories. You're fine with either.
Turning to the contract issue, the law on that is also settled, no dispute. Courts are supposed to interpret contracts as written, use the language the parties chose. You don't, even if the court thinks it's a bad bargain, they don't get to make a new bargain for the parties. Even if they think there's some evidence the parties wanted to do something else, you enforce the language that the parties chose to use. You construe all the language so none's meaningless, and courts don't add language. In this case, the district court's opinion completely negates several clauses to the agreement. You start with the premise that in this AMI, and you know, there's some talk by appellees as to what AMI's areas of mutual interest are intended to do, but again, we got to look at what the parties wanted to do in this one. And they said the obligation to share is going to be only of acquired interest. Those are defined in 2.1 to have three criteria. It's got to be within the AMI, both geographically and, as we'll see, not excluded. It's got to be acquired after the effective date, and it's got to be acquired by a partner. That's 2.1. There's an exception in section 2.3 that says, All interest, leases, or agreements owned by a party prior to the effective date, including non-consent interest acquired under existing JOAs, shall not be considered part of or subject to the AMI. Similar exception in 1.4 of the amendment that allowed new parties to ratify this agreement. It says if a new party owned interest within the AMI prior to the effective date, then upon ratification, such interest shall be excluded from the AMI. And then the actual ratification does it a third time. All interest owned by a new party prior to the effective date shall not be considered part of or subject to the AMI. That takes those out. Now, if it only takes them out while that party owns it, then 2.3 becomes completely unnecessary, because the definition of 2.1 already says it's got to be acquired after the effective date. 2.3 is talking about stuff acquired before the effective date.
So what's outside can never come in?
Yes.
Under your understanding of the agreement.
Yes, Judge. It speaks of interest. You know, it speaks of real property interest is not in the AMI. It doesn't say it's not in the AMI while owned by the original party.
There's nothing that can happen after the date of the contract to make something in AMI that wasn't already in AMI.
Right.
That's your whole position.
It's no different, Judge, than if we had an adequate map. You know, well, this property is only 100 feet outside the boundary. Why shouldn't that come in? Well, because the party said it's not going to come in, and that's the choice they made. It's, you know, Judge Ho asked the question in the prior argument, if the statute says weekly and it can mean something other than weekly, then why is the word in there? So I would say if 2.3 doesn't do anything, why is it in there? Their argument, best they can do, is, well, 2.3 is there to make explicit what 2.1 makes implicit. And that's like saying, okay, well, 2.1 says to be an acquired interest, it's got to be acquired after the effective date. Well, we better put another paragraph in there to make sure that people don't think after means before. That doesn't make sense. 2.3 has a purpose that the trial court's construction completely eliminates. And there are other exemptions in here that do something different, that do something different than 2.3. For example, 2.1 says, an acquired interest will not include any interest acquired by Glassell non-operating interest from the estates of Alfred C. Glassell or Claire Glassell. Well, that's doing something different, because those estates are not party to this development agreement. So if you didn't have that exclusion in there, then Glassell went to acquire interest from these estates, and these estates aren't parties, so Glassell would have to offer these interests under the agreement. So that's an exception that does something different than 2.3.
Do you seek render?
Yes. We're asking for the court to reverse and render judgment for Interquest. The other exception they rely on is 2.13. That deals with exchanges between Yates and Jalapeno, who are related entities. And it says those acquisitions aren't going to be subject to the sharing. But it's not limited to any time. So that serves a purpose that 2.3 doesn't serve, because if Jalapeno acquired some interest in the AMI after the effective date, let's say it offers it up and some take, some don't, and then maybe 2 years later, Yates says, for estate planning purposes or whatever reason,
it just lets them pass it back and forth.
Right.
Triggering.
2 years later, but for 2.13, because these were acquired after the effective date, Yates would have to offer it, and 2.3 would not save Yates from that. So 2.13 and 2.1 exclusions are doing something different than 2.3, and I cannot think of an example where 2.3 would have a function under the district court's interpretation, because if it only applies while they own it, while the parties own it, interest acquired before the effective date, then again, they don't fall under the definition of 2.1 to begin with. There's no need for the 2.3 exclusion. So we do ask the court to reverse and render on both of those grounds. In the alternative, at the very least, on the partial performance exception, the judge erred in determining a disputed fact issue, but as I said, we don't think they even generated a genuine issue of disputed fact.
Thank you.
I'm going to give you all 10 seconds back.
Thank you, counsel. We have your argument.
Your Honor, and may it please the court, David Weiner appearing for the plaintiff appellees. There are two issues, of course, in this case, whether the contract applies to the DKE and Patty DeBoe's interests that EnerQuest acquired here, and whether the contract complies with the statute of frauds. Like counsel for EnerQuest, I'd like to start with the statute of frauds and hopefully clear up some of the issues surrounding the location of the AMI and why we think that this is a perfect fit under the Texas statute of frauds. There's a little bit of confusion, I think, about what the boundaries are, and we've reproduced in, it's the bottom of page 8 in the in our brief, but we've also reproduced for you in this packet that the clerk, I think, handed out. And if you just look at the first page in that packet, and this is a copy of the more legible version of the Sitel map. This is the color version of it. This is exactly in its native size. This is from the ROA at 337. And if you look, if you're holding that in portrait orientation, and if you look on the right-hand side, the vertical axis, and you locate the middle coordinate from the state plane system, it's 246000. And then you move about 1 inch into the center of the map, you'll pick up the vertical line there that is the boundary of the AMI. Judge Elrod, if you're holding it in landscape orientation, if you just go from the bottom, if you're looking at the bottom axis and you go up essentially 1 inch from that middle coordinate, you run smack into the boundary of the AMI. And you can follow that boundary in either direction until you run into those thick lines. And you'll see that that bottom half of the AMI, the southern half of the AMI, has the notation in the middle, 16.16 square miles. The northern half, the northern portion of the AMI has that notation, 24.10 square miles. That matches up exactly with the size of the tracks that are set forth in the Sitel agreement, which defines the boundaries here in the first place. So this color version, this more legible version of the Sitel map, shows you the boundaries of the AMI. The second page in the document that that we have for you, that is the version of the map that our surveyor, Ms. Foster, created. That's from ROA 301. And you can see that the shape of the AMI matches perfectly with the color version, the legible version of the Sitel map. They're a perfect match. This version of the map, it shows you the complete boundaries, it shows you the locations. There's no issue about the boundaries extending below the map or anything like that. It's all there. And it's not disputed in the record that this more legible version of the map shows the entire boundaries of the AMI. Now, this leads to the next question. Can we look at this more legible version of the AMI, of the Sitel map? And here again, we're going to switch over to Coe versus Chesapeake. And there's obviously been a lot of discussion in the briefs about this case. EnerQuest has suggested that we've completely misinterpreted Coe because the Coe opinion says at footnote 22 that the maps are identical. And it's true that's what footnote 22 says, but if you look in the Coe opinion, at the bottom of 317, top of 318 in Coe, what it actually says is that it describes all of the features that you can see in the maps, the county lines, the water boundary lines, and it says that in Exhibit 52B, which is the enlarged version of the Coe map, you can see the names of the surveys and the abstract numbers. And the inference you draw from that, of course, is that in the agreement version of the map, you can't see the survey names and the abstract numbers. Now, I know EnerQuest has reproduced those maps for you in their reply brief. And the way they're reproduced, they do look awfully similar. But if you actually go to the district court record in Coe and you look at the maps, you see something very different. And that's what we've reproduced for you. The third map in that packet is the original version of the agreement map from Coe. And you can see that you absolutely cannot read the names of the surveys. You cannot read the abstract numbers. The fourth page of the map is the actual size of Exhibit 52B from Coe. That's the enlarged version of that map. That map was 50 by 30.6 inches. That map was nearly as wide as I am tall. And you can very clearly see in that enlarged version of the map that you can read quite clearly the names of the surveys and the abstract numbers. This court said that was fine. It's there in Coe, the original map, that enlarged version of the map, they came from the same electronic file, and it was permissible to use those maps to identify the location of the interests that were being conveyed by Peak to Chesapeake. Now, EnerQuest says that Coe is a recital of ownership case, and therefore it's distinguishable. And while there was a recital of ownership, the key fact in Coe, though, was that it was limited to the shaded areas on the map. So you absolutely needed to know the location of those shaded areas. And they were able to do that. They were permitted to do that by a surveyor using that enlarged map. So we've got boundaries here. We've got size. We've got shape. Texas law holds that if you have the nucleus of description, you can use extrinsic evidence in order to identify the location with reasonable certainty using the data in the memorandum. Well, we have the size, we have the shape, we have the boundaries, we also have the general location. And they cite the Ryland versus Patrick Thomas saying that in order to have the general location, you need the survey and the counties. Well, we have the counties on the map, and we have the boundaries of the survey lines as well. And our surveyor, Ms. Foster, identified in her supplemental declaration that she, based on her knowledge of the area, she was able to identify that these are in fact survey lines. What's more, what we also have here in order to identify the general location of the AMI is we have the fact that this is plotted according to the coordinates on the state plane system. So we have yet another mechanism included in the map to ground the location and provide the nucleus of description. So once we have the nucleus of description, then it's permissible under Texas law to use extrinsic evidence. And here, the extrinsic evidence that was being used are the CITEL data files. And it is absolutely correct that you can't just use any old extrinsic evidence under Texas law in order to provide the location with reasonable certainty. There's got to be some linkage to the data in the memorandum. And we have that here. Because the CITEL mapping files, all that they do is they provide the specific information for the coordinates on the state plane system for that AMI boundary. So this is just like in some of the cases we've cited, Wiggins, for example, or Coe itself, where you can have a reference to ownership in a county, and that opens the door to looking at the general land office records or the county property records. In Coe, they were permitted an unlimited review of county land records.
Okay, but if you just look at the CITEL map, you cannot tell the terminus of the AMI boundary, correct?
In the agreement version of the map, the less legible version, that's correct. But if we look at the more legible color version, that's at 337, you can see the complete boundary.
And in the agreement version, you can't tell what happens when a tract is cut through by dissected by the boundary line, can you?
I'm not sure. I mean,
when a tract has got the boundary line running through it, we don't know the exact place where that happens.
I see where the survey lines, where it doesn't strictly follow the survey lines. So you can't see it with absolute precision. You can see it that it is plotted according to the state plane coordinates, and then you do need the mapping data in order to drill down to get the exact precision that you would need to identify that location with reasonable certainty. So I do think that's even if you put aside the more legible version of the color map, and I would note that the Coe case is really the most, they have not cited any case where there has been another issue of having a map and one version is legible and one version is not. Coe is the only case that anybody has been able to locate and that supports using the more legible color map here. But that is right, Your Honor, that if you're just looking at the original version of the map, it doesn't show you the complete boundary. The more legible color version does give you that complete boundary. And then, as our surveyor explained, that using the Sitel mapping files, essentially all that you're doing is you're literally just pinpointing with a higher degree of accuracy where the points on the perimeter of the AMI are on the state plane system.
Do you agree that you can't tell about the 166 acres, that they're not part, they're not within the AMI?
No, I don't agree with that. Those arguments from their surveyor assume that you're not able to make a complete enclosure. They assume that you're not able to look at the mapping data. I mean,
doesn't make a complete enclosure, the actual map. The actual map does not make a complete enclosure.
The original version of it. It does, it's just that it's not legible. And there's not a dispute in the record that the color version of the map at 337 is the same map, and it's just a more legible version of it. Again, it's the same thing as in Coe, where the original version of the map, the abstract names and survey numbers are completely illegible on it. You can't see them at all. They appear as squiggles. But if you look at the enlarged version of the Coe map that was described as identical by the court, you can read all of that very, very clearly. It's clear as day. And so if in Coe you can use this 50 by 36 inch version of a map that has information legible on it that's not legible on an 8.5 by 11 inch version of a map that's attached to an agreement, then we think Coe stands for the proposition that
some sort of transitive property of Coe, that because that map could be, you could use that other map, we can use that other map here.
But the reason in Coe that you could use the larger version of the map is, as this court said, is because they came from the same data. They came from the same electronic file. And that's exactly the case here. The Slay Declaration at 584 in the record says the same thing, that the original version of the map and the more legible color version of the map were made at the same time using the same data source, the mapping files. And that's why all these maps look the same. I think we certainly agree that we need the mapping data in order to establish the location with reasonable certainty. And as I said, Coe is the only case that anybody has identified involving a situation like this one, where you have a map attached to a document, attached to the agreement, and it's clear, I mean, it's been copied so many times that not all of the features on it are legible. The record contains another version of the map that is more legible and shows all of the features. It's not disputed that it's the same version, that it's the same map. Their surveyor simply basically ignores it. Their surveyor ignores the mapping data and doesn't dispute that if you can look at the mapping data, that you can identify the AMI's boundaries with reasonable certainty. So it really comes down to this issue of whether or not you can consider the mapping data. There are no other questions on the statute of frauds. I'll turn over to the contract issue. And here, Section 2.3, Section 2.1 distinguish between two types of interests. They distinguish, on the one hand, between interests that are owned before the effective date, and alternatively, the contract focuses on the acquisition of interests after the effective date. And if you acquire an interest after the effective date under 2.1, you have to offer to share it. 2.3 doesn't use the word acquire, doesn't say anything about happens when a party to the agreement acquires an interest that another party owned from before the effective date. Now, under EnerQuest's interpretation, what that means is that you could have an interest that a party owned 5 years before the effective date. They sell it to somebody else, they sell it to somebody else, they sell it and on and on and on. and then 10 years down the road, it gets acquired by a party to the agreement, and under EnerQuest's interpretation, that party doesn't have to offer to share it with any of the other parties to the AMI because it was owned prior to the effective date by a party. Now, that's an incredibly difficult structure to administer. It's not clear why the parties would have entered into such an agreement, why prior held interests have such talismanic presence. And what's more is that the plain language of 2.3 is very different from the language of 2.1.
Is your point 2.3 under that theory of 2.3 is just very difficult to administer? You have to do title searches way back when?
You would have to do title searches.
Okay, so that's one possible reading of 2.3. It's not the only. You could read 2.3 as you own it at the time or right before the effective date. I'm not sure that's what the parties are.
That's true.
Doing, but we can avoid your administrability problem that way.
Even if you limit 2.3, I think you would have to change the language of 2.3 to say interests owned at the time of the effective date, which
fair
is
enough.
What the party said. But Judge Ho, even if we agree to that reformation of 2.3, you still have the administrability issue because you could have an interest, take the interests here, DKE and Patty DuBose. They sell them to a third party. That third party sells them to a fourth party, and on and on and on. And then EnerQuest buys it 5 years down the road after multiple transfers. And at that point, you'd have to engage in that same title search to figure out whether or not, at the time of the effective date, it was owned by a party to the agreement.
So what if their argument that, under your theory, 2.3 is essentially surplusage?
I don't think it's surplusage at all, Your Honor. For it does make explicit what is implicit in 2.1. And I think there are two points. Number one, I think it adds that explicit element to the contract.
What's two, implicit?
I'm sorry?
What's the implicit that needs to be made?
In 2.1, the idea that when you come into the agreement, that those interests that you have, you get to keep. And this is something that parties do all the time. I think the Scalia-Garner encapsulation of the surplusage canon is exactly right, which is that surplusage canon isn't absolute, precisely because the underlying premise, the predicate, isn't invariably true.
But what's in need of clarification here? Nobody thinks after means before.
But when you have private parties coming into an agreement with interests that are worth a lot of money, it is an eminently reasonable thing to do for them to say to their lawyer, you know what, I want a belt and suspenders here. I'm not going to rely on 2.1. I know what it says, but I want 2.3 to make it abundantly clear so there is no confusion. And what's more, Your Honor, look at the language of the carve-outs in 2.13 and the Glassell carve-out in 2.1. Those carve-outs use very specific language that's absent in 2.3. Specifically, in 2.13, this is the Yates-Jalapeno carve-out. It talks about if Yates acquires an interest from Jalapeno at any time, it doesn't have to offer to share that interest with any other party, right? So the parties know how to use very precise language when they want to make it clear that you don't have to offer to share an interest that you acquire after the effective date. They didn't use that language in 2.3. Their construction of 2.3 takes a provision that talks only about ownership of interests, and they transform it into a provision that also governs and limits what happens when you acquire an interest. And the parties were very clear in 2.1 that the acquisition of the interest, that is sort of the key fulcrum on which this AMI operates. And instead, what they have done is they're creating a structure in which the parties to the AMI are effectively in competition with one another for these pre-owned interests. That doesn't make a lot of sense. The idea behind the AMI is mutual cooperation to develop the interests within this boundary system. EnerQuest's interpretation destroys that function, and again, it casts the parties in competition against one another.
Well, but they're only grandfathering in properties within the AMI that are pre-owned. That doesn't sound unreasonable to me.
Well, it's not unreasonable if you're talking about do you have to offer to share them at the time you join as opposed to acquiring them after the effective date. If you're talking about do you have to offer to share them after the effective date, then they absolutely are in competition with one another. And this case shows that.
Well, I mean, something's outside the bounds. It's always, I mean, outside the pool. It's always outside the pool. Why isn't that a reasonable, why isn't that what it says?
Well, it's not part of the AMI. It's exactly what it says.
But it doesn't say anything about happens when you acquire it. And if you look at 2.1, the language of 2.1, it says the AMI shall cover and apply to, and it has four criteria. One, and I apologize, Your Honor, my red light is on.
If this is an answer to the question, you can proceed.
I'm a direct answer to your question, and you'll tell me if you disagree. So the criteria for the to have an acquired interest is that, number one, it's got to be the proper type of interest, lease, or agreement. Number two is that it has to be an interest, lease, or agreement that is related to lands located wholly or partly within the AMI. Right, so what that is it's creating a geographic restriction on the interests, and then finally, it's got to be after the effective date. And so what they have done is they've taken that section, they've sort of read out that second requirement, lands located wholly within or part of the AMI, and they've turned it into a requirement that in order to have an acquired interest, you have to be covered by the AMI. That's not the language that they used in Section 2.1. The parties used very different language in 2.1 from 2.3, and under Texas law, the court is compelled to follow the language that the parties used. If the court has no further questions, we ask that the court
affirm. Thank you. Thank you.
You know, we have a second break. This could be a long another case.
I think Judge Ho got it exactly right. What is belt and suspenders if not surplusage? It's two things doing the same thing. And there's no, 2.3 has no meaning under their interpretation. It's just there as again to say, when we said after, we didn't mean before. The reference to administrative difficulties, two points on that. One, the main point is, even if that's true, it doesn't matter. Because the law is, we interpret the contract the parties made. And if maybe they have a provision that's gonna be difficult to enforce, then that's the language they choose. It's not this court's job, it's not the district court's job to say, well, we're gonna give you a better deal.
I assume if somebody wants to invoke 2.3 to avoid sharing, it's incumbent on them to present that information.
Yes, I mean, and that's what,
words on that.
Yes, our president said a mistake in email and then had not read the provision, went back and read it and said, it doesn't count. And it, you know, people do title searches when they buy real property. And they figure out this is what we're getting, this is what we're not getting. Oil and gas leases frequently have depth limitations, and you got to figure out, okay, we're only getting in, I think the Chesapeake case had a depth limitation just below the Cotton Valley formation. So that's not a reason to not enforce the language that the parties chose to use.
Is this kind of language, pardon my ignorance, is this common in oil and gas lease agreements, or is this a pretty sui generis situation?
In my experience with area mutual interest agreements, Judge, and of course, they can all be different, right? But it is common for parties to basically look prospectively and say, what we have, what we already have, we're not sharing. But going forward, when we go out and get new stuff that none of us have, we will share it.
It strikes me that then if this is common, this is a pretty weighty question of Texas law. Is this something we should certify?
In terms of, I don't
certify the Texas Supreme Court. That way, the entire community knows what the law is, as opposed to a Fifth Circuit ruling that's only applicable to federal disputes.
I don't think there's an issue under Texas law as to whether this clause means what it says. I mean, I don't. This is the only case I know of where someone is saying 2.3 says they're not subject to the AMI, but oh wait, they are subject to the AMI. I'm not aware of any jurisprudential issue that we would need the Texas Supreme Court to weigh in on. I think the court can simply read the language and say, we're going to construe the contract so that all these terms have meaning, And the only way for 2.3 to have meaning is if it means what it says, these interests are not subject to the AMI. What they say is they're not subject to the AMI unless down the road you want to convey them. And the whole bidding war, again, whether or not that was a good idea, whether or not it was a bad idea, is not the court's job. But if I'm a party and I've gone to the trouble to say I'm going to keep this interest, wouldn't I want the ability to sell it at the highest price? And the most likely people to buy are the people that are in this area. So I think that rather than being contrary to our position, it supports our position. Yes, I mean, why do I want to retain property and then limit the marketability of it down the road? Now, turning to the map, you cannot look at the map on the Sitel agreement and see this new boundary. It's not there. Even the more legible color copy, how do you know where the boundary is? The boundary looks like this big, thick, black thing. You have, the only way they get a different boundary other than this big, thick black boundary, it's for Nedra Foster to ask for proprietary shape files, which the evidence is clear, it really wouldn't matter whether they had been exchanged between the parties before the agreement, because case law says the map's not attached, it doesn't matter even if the parties exchanged a map. But the evidence here was that it wasn't. This shape file data was not exchanged between the parties prior to the agreement. So they have to go use extrinsic data to create the location. As Judge Elrod mentioned in your question, you can't tell the boundary on the map attached to the agreement. I don't think you can even tell it on this color copy, because you have to somehow say, okay, although we've got these big black lines here that certainly look like a boundary, they're really not the boundary, because what the real boundary is, we got to dig in here and find this little squiggly line. And if that's the case, why is it this one? Why is it not that squiggly line? The only way they get to their shape is relying on the shape files, which you didn't hear counsel say that the shape files or the mapping data was identified on the map or in the agreement, because they weren't. We ask the court to reverse and render judgment in favor of Interquest. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. We have your arguments. This case is submitted. The court will take a brief recess before considering.